Welcome to The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This episode features an hour with Lee Young Lee as part of Poetry Downtown in 2008. Lee is the son of exiled Chinese parents who first fled to Jakarta, where Lee was born, and then to the United States, where they finally settled. He is considered a supremely lyric poet whose work verges on the mystical, and he's admired nationally as a major American voice. The poet Gerald Stern has noted, "What characterizes Lee's work is a certain humility, a willingness to let the sublime enter his field of concentration and take over, a devotion to language, a belief in its holiness." The other day I was having lunch with Kim Stafford. Kim is the author of over a dozen books of poetry and prose, and is also the son of the poet William Stafford. Kim said to me that poetry is like pure scientific research. It explores the truth in language with no expectation that it will be immediately useful. I find this a useful way to think about poetry and why it matters so much. Where would we be without the scientists who seek the truth and nothing else in our world? And where would we be without the people who seek the truth about our human condition? This seems universally important, and I think listening to Lee this way can open us up to what he's discovering through language. Lee is the author of four collections of poems, including the 2008 collection, My Eyes. He is the recipient of numerous prizes, including a fellowship from the Academy of American Poets and the William Carlos Williams Award. Here's Lee Young Lee.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I ate a handful of hazelnuts last night, and I'm allergic to hazelnuts, and I haven't quite recovered, so I'm sucking on a cough drop. Thank you to all the powers that be that made this possible. I can do nothing but disappoint you now. I actually have a program that I'm going to try to stick to. I should get rid of this cough drop, right? I'm gonna set it right there. Okay. May the God of nuts not wreak havoc. This is called Station. Station. Your attention, please. Train number 9, the Northern Zephyr, destined for River's End, is now boarding. All ticketed passengers, please proceed to the gate marked Evening. Your attention, please. Train number 7. Leaves blown by. Bound for the color of thinking and renovated time is now departing. All ticketed passengers may board behind my eyes. Your attention, please. Train number 4, the 20th century, has joined the wind, undisguised, to become the written word. Those who never heard their names may inquire at the uneven margin of this story, or else consult the ivy lying awake under our open window. Your attention, please. The music, arriving out of hidden ground and endlessly beginning, is now the flower, now the fruit, now our cup and cheer, under branches more ancient than our grandmother's hair. Passengers with memories of the sea may board leisurely at any unmarked gate. Fateful members of the foam may proceed to Cloud and Veronica. Your attention, please. Under falling petals, never think about home. Seeing begins in the dark. Listening stills us. Yesterday has gone ahead to meet you. Your attention, please. Train number 66. Unbidden song. Soon to be the full heart's quiet. Takes no passengers. Please leave your baggage with the attendant at the window marked your name sprung from hiding. An intrepid perfume is waging our rescue. You may board at either end of childhood.
I'm going to drink this whole glass. Maybe that'll help. And then I'll have to go to the bathroom. This is great. I think it has something to do with the eclipse. I just figured that out. Maybe I'll say a few words just to give you a kind of context. You know, I wrote most of these poems out of a mistaken idea. I thought that in order to access some sort of primordial condition of original mind, as the Buddhists call it, or true mind, as the Taoists call it, or the mind of God, as the Judeo-Christian tradition refers to it, I thought that one would have to work through all the layers of childhood, through and beyond childhood, to enact a remembrance that is beyond my personal history in order to get to some sort of memory that is pre-personality. Of course, when I tried to do that, I recognized that there were certain childhood traumas and things that I would have to encounter in order to do that. But now I realize, after years of trying to do that, that that's not the way to go about it, because our original condition can't be somewhere back in time. That can't be true. It must be here and now, or nowhere. But these poems I'm reading were written out of that ignorance. So this is called The Children's Hour. This is comes out of a memory. The year I was born, there was a five-year period around that time when 500,000 Chinese were killed in Indonesia. The Children's Hour. Soldiers with guns are at our door again. Sister, quick, turn yourself into a penny. I'll fold you in a handkerchief, put you in my pocket, and jump inside a sack, one of the uncooked rice. Brother, hurry. Turn yourself into one of our mother's dolls on the living room shelf. I'll be the dust settling on your eyelids. The ones wearing wings are in the house. The ones wearing lightning are in the yard. The ones wearing stars and carrying knives are dividing our futures among them. Don't answer when they call to us
in the voice of Nanny. Don't listen when they promise sugar. Don't come out until evening, or when you hear our mother weeping to herself. If only I could become her morning mirror, I'd never come back until the end of time.
This poem is called Have You Prayed? And it's something my father asked me when I was a child. He asked me every morning, and every morning I lied to him and said yes. Have you prayed? When the wind turns and asks in my father's voice, have you prayed? I know three things. One, I'm never finished answering to the dead. Two, a man is four winds and three fires. And the four winds are his father's voice, his mother's voice, or maybe he's seven winds and ten fires. And the fires are seeing, hearing, touching, dreaming, thinking. Or is he the breath of God? When the wind turns traveler and asks in my father's voice, have you prayed? I remember three things. One, a father's love is milk and sugar, two-thirds worry, two-thirds grief, and what's left over is trimmed and leavened to make the bread the dead and the living share. And patience? That's to endure the terrible leavening and kneading. And wisdom? That's my father's face in sleep. When the wind asks, have you prayed? I know it's only me, reminding myself a flower is one station between Earth's wish and Earth's rapture. And blood was fire, salt, and breath long before it quickened any wand or branch, any limb that woke speaking. It's just me in the gowns of the wind, or my father through me asking, have you found your refuge yet? Asking, are you happy? Strange, a troubled father, a happy son, the wind with a voice, and me talking to no one. I'm really sorry. I knew, you know, I was eating those nuts. They were so good. I knew I was allergic to them, and I had two of them, and I thought, oh, those are so good. I had two more. Next thing I know, they were all gone. And this poem is called Self-Help for Fellow Refugees. I had heard that self-help books were the biggest selling books in the world, so I thought I'd write a self-help poem. I expected to be rich and famous by now, but it has not happened. Self-help for fellow refugees. If your name suggests a country where bells might have been used for entertainment or to announce the entrances and exits of the seasons or the birthdays of gods and demons, it's probably best to dress in plain clothes when you arrive in the United States. And try not to talk too loud. If you happen to have watched armed men beat and drag your father out the front door of your house and into the back of an idling truck before your mother jerked you from the threshold and buried your face in her skirt folds, try not to judge your mother too harshly. Don't ask her what she thought she was doing, turning a child's eyes away from history and toward that place all human aching starts. And if you meet someone in your adopted country and think you see in the other's face an open sky, some promise of a new beginning, it probably means you're standing too far. Or if you think you read in the other, as in a book, whose first and last pages are missing, the story of your own birthplace, a country twice erased, once by fire, once by forgetfulness, it probably means you're standing too close. In any case, try not to let another carry the burden of your own nostalgia or hope. And if you're one of those whose left side of the face doesn't match the right, it might be a clue looking the other way was a habit your predecessors found useful for survival. Don't lament not being beautiful. Get used to seeing while not seeing. Get busy remembering while forgetting. Dying to live while not wanting to go on. Very likely, your ancestors decorated their bells of every shape and size. Very likely, your ancestors decorated their bells of every shape and size with elaborate calendars and diagrams of distant star systems, but with no maps for scattered descendants. And I bet you can't say what language your father spoke when he shouted to your mother from the back of the truck, "Let the boy see." Maybe it wasn't the language you used at home. Maybe it was a forbidden language. Or maybe there was too much screaming and weeping and the noise of guns in the streets. It doesn't matter. What matters is this: the kingdom of heaven is good, but heaven on earth is better. Thinking is good, but living is better.
alone in your favorite chair, with a book you enjoy, is fine. But spooning is even better.
You know, I'm grossing myself out up here. This is like it's like exposed plumbing or something. I'm really sorry about this. I don't know whether the water is helping or not. It sounds okay. Thank you. I can hear every little bubbling, gurgling. Just in case you didn't hear it, I wanted to tell you. Okay.
This poem begins with a phrase that my father said to me when I used to say to me a lot when he was convincing us to learn to speak English. You know, my mother and my father argued a lot about this. My father was under the impression that if we learned to speak English well and we learned to pass, that we could somehow, it would, you know, allow us to get through certain things. And my mother wanted us to keep the Chinese language as much as possible. And I had an experience. My wife and I took our kids to Italy when they were very little. And we were very happy and excited because friends had told us that Europe was one of the most enlightened places on the planet, and there was no racism. I know. I believed them. And so we went, and I noticed something, that if we were walking down the street and I was holding my children's hands or I had my arms around them, they would be harassed for being half, for being Asian. Their mother is Italian-American, so they're mixed blood. But I noticed that if I walked 10 or 15 feet away from them, they could pass. And so I started, you know, keeping my distance. And my wife was very disturbed. She said, "That's not a good message you're sending to them." And my feeling was, well, what am I supposed to do, you know? I wanted to keep them from, you know, from being called names and so on. So we had that experience. And then when they were a little bigger, they went back to Italy on their own. And before they went, they'd been studying Italian for many years. And I told them, look, really get that language down and maybe you can pass, because if I'm not around, nobody can tell what you are, you know. So after their first week there, we were talking to them on the phone, and I asked them how things were going, and my oldest son said, well, I keep getting harassed for being Jewish. And so our nickname for him now is Boychik. That's true. And this poem is kind of inspired by that experience. This is called Immigrant Blues. People have been trying to kill me since I was born, a man tells his son, trying to explain the wisdom of learning a second tongue. It's an old story from the previous century about my father and me. The same old story from yesterday morning about me and my son. It's called Survival Strategies and the Melancholy of Racial Assimilation. It's called Psychological Paradigms of Displaced Persons, called The Child Who'd Rather Play Than Study. Practice until you feel the language inside you, says the man. But what does he know about inside and outside? My father who was spared nothing, in spite of the languages he used, and me, confused about the flesh and the soul, who asked once into a telephone, "Am I inside you?" "You're always inside me," a woman answered, "at peace with the body's finitude, at peace with the soul's disregard of space and time." "Am I inside you?" I asked once, lying between her legs, confused about the body and the heart. "If you don't believe you're inside me, you're not," she answered, "at peace with the body's greed, at peace with the heart's bewilderment." It's an ancient story from yesterday evening called Patterns of Love in Peoples of Diaspora, called Loss of the Home Place and the Defilement of the Beloved, called I Want to Sing, but I Don't Know Any Songs. I'll read two more poems. These are two love poems. You know, my experience with romantic love is complicated, as is anybody's. You know, before you fall in love, before you find somebody who loves you, you're isolated and terrified and lonely. Then you fall in love, and you are overwhelmed and inhabited by giant feelings, you know, and thoughts and cosmic-sized angels walking in and out of you, and you can't articulate these feelings to anybody. And then you find that you can't even articulate them to the beloved, and you're more lonely than when you started. So, but I have a theory about that. I think that's the way I think it's supposed to. Romantic love, maybe, ultimately, is supposed to bring you to a place where you encounter God. And so it's a way to wean you from the world, and then from the beloved, the mortal beloved, to discover an immortal beloved. But I might be wrong, I don't know. This is called Trading for Heaven. Trading for Heaven. I saw you at the top of the stairs. Now I live a secret life. I saw you holding open the door. Now I'm filling pages with things I can't tell anyone. Now, I'm more alone than I've ever been. I traded every beyond, every someday, for heaven in my lifetime. Now, I'm dying of my life. Now, I'm alive inside my death. Do you see the space between our bodies? Barely a hand, hardly a breath. It is the space mountains and rivers are made of. It is the beginning of oceans. The space between either and or, both and neither. The happiness of forgetting our names and the happiness of hearing them for the first time. I heard you singing yourself to sleep. It was a song from both of our childhoods. And now, I don't know if singing is a form of helplessness, time's architecture revealed, or some inborn motive all blood and breath obey to enact a savage wheel. I found you at dawn, sitting by the open kitchen window. You were sorting seeds in a plate. And if you were praying out loud, I'll never tell. And if you were listening to the doves, and if their various hooing and cooing and dying in time are your earliest questions blown back to you through the ragged seasons, and if you've lived your life in answer to those questions, I'll never tell. Your destiny is safe with me. Your childhood is safe with me. What you decide to bury is safe with me. Boy, you know, poets are so treacherous. This whole poem said I would never tell, and here I am reading about it to a whole room. Actually, I was going to read one more poem, but I'm looking at this clock, and I think we only have 15 minutes left to take questions. I'll read one more. Oh, thank you. Oh, thanks. Thank you. This is called Virtues of the Boring Husband. This is a completely autobiographical self-portrait. Thank you very much for your generous attention. Virtues of the Boring Husband. Whenever I talk, my wife falls asleep. This is true. This is just straight autobiography. So now, when she can't sleep, I talk. It's like magic. Say she hasn't had a good night's sleep in a week, feels exhausted, and lies down early in the evening, but begins to toss and turn. I just lie down beside her, prop my head up in one hand and say, "You know, I've been thinking." Immediately, she calms down, finds a fetal posture, and tucks her head under my arm. I know she lies dispersed, though in one body, claimed by rabble cares and the need to sleep. "Will you stay?" she asks. "I'm right here," I answer. "Now what were you saying?" she wonders, and so I talk. It isn't that lovers always meet in a garden, and already her eyes get that dizzy look, like she can't focus. "Go ahead," I tell her, "close your eyes." "Okay," she says, "but you keep talking." And so I do. It isn't that lovers always speak together in a house by the sea, or in a room with shadows of leaves and branches on the walls and ceiling. It's that such spaces emerge out of the listening they're speaking to each other engenders.
I mean, maybe. And she sighs. Her breathing begins to slow. And I remember something I heard somewhere. Every so many breaths, a sigh. Every so many sighs, sleep. Or was it every so many sighs, death? I go on talking, now stroking her head, pushing her hair back from her forehead, clearing her bright brow, and listening for her next sigh. Maybe the face-to-face, true lovers in act, manifests a prior coincidence of heaven and earth, say, or body and soul. Equal opposites exchanging and combining properties in perpetual transformation. Shore and not shore. Sea and sky. Room and a world. The gazer and the gazed upon. Little twitches run the length of her, beginning with her arms, then her legs, then her feet, as though tensions were being fired from her body. She mumbles the beginning of a word. I go on talking. Maybe the union of lovers is an instance of a primary simultaneity, timeless, from which arises the various shapes of time and duration, arrival, departure, waiting, resuming, fountain, terrace, path, and eve. And maybe any world is born, is offspring of the liaison between God and mind, mind and mind's source. I count her second sigh, lower, longer. Or maybe God says, I love you, and the whole universe, consciousness included, is a shape of that pronouncement. Or maybe there's no you in that, but only I love, ringing, engendering all of space, every quadrant, an expression of God's first nature, I love. Or maybe a you arises as echo, the counter-ringing to the sovereign I love. And we're the you to the source's I, the second person to God's first personhood. Then, to surrender any sense of an I is to feel our true condition, a you before God, and to be seen. Being seen, the crowning experience and mystery of a you. Maybe too often we mistake the guest for the host, confusing the I and the you, and yet, maybe, out of that confusion, more worlds arise. By now, she's barely listening, if at all. I lower my voice and go on rambling, afraid she'll wake if I stop too soon. Maybe love for God amounts to the beloved returning the lover's gaze. And out of that look and looking back, that linking look, all of our notions of space, home, distance, beginning, end, recurrence, death, debt, fruition, number, weight, emerge. All are issue of that meeting between lover and lover. our soul's intercourse with what it loves. By now, her jaw has gone slack, her fingers loose, where earlier they were clenching the edge of the blanket, and I'm almost whispering. Maybe it's true, what sages have said. I don't know if I'm remembering it right. Something about moving up a ladder of love. Maybe we learn to love a person, say, first as object, and then as presence, and then as essence, and then as disclosure of the divine. Or maybe all at the same time, or discovering over time each deeper aspect to be true. And maybe our seeing it in another proves that face inside ourselves. Oh, I don't know. You sleep now. And then I stop talking, kiss her forehead, and wait a minute before leaving the bed and closing the door behind me. Thank you very much. I have a bunch of questions here. I can't answer them all, but how do I decide which ones to answer? Really? Close my eyes and pick one? Okay, here we go. Your new book includes an audio CD. Cool. Why is it important to read or hear poetry out loud? How is it different than simply hearing it in your head? You know, I talked a little bit about this afternoon. I don't know how many of you are here from this afternoon. At the risk of repeating myself, I'll say this. A poem is like a musical score for the human voice. The way, you know, if you have a musical score, you play violin or something, the instrument is the voice. So a poem is a score for human speech. And the nature of speech is that all speech is done with the outgoing breath, the exhaled breath. That is the dying breath. You can't breathe in and talk at the same time. But the nature of breathing is this. When you breathe in, your body fills with life. Your blood is filled with oxygen. Your muscles get firm. Your bones actually get harder when you inhale. Your skin gets flushed with nutrients. When you breathe out, your bones actually soften. Nutrients leave the bloodstream, and you're exhaling. It's called the dying breath. But the nature of speech is that it's only done with the dying breath. So you could say that a poem is a score for the dying breath. But the speech, though, has this little contract. And it's this. You can feed yourself, feed your life with the in-breath. As you begin to talk, you breathe out. You start exercising the dying breath. You start dying. But the more you say, the more your meaning gets disclosed, but the less breath you have. So meaning increases in opposite ratio to vitality. Vitality decreases in opposite ratio to meaning. Does that make sense? Now, in this way, speech is a small paradigm for our human being, our lives, because as we die, we have less life, the more the meaning of our lives gets disclosed. And it's a mystery to us, the meaning of our lives, until, you know, well, until late. I think what happens is that a poet, either consciously or unconsciously, is aware of this and tries to ransom that dying breath by packing as much meaning as possible into that breath. And that's why I think a poem has the most amount of information per square inch. You know, and I don't mean just information about, you know, my specific childhood or something like that, but feeling, thought, spirit, soul, eternity, all of that gets packed into a poem. And in this way, I think the ultimate paradigm for a poem is DNA, the most amount of information packed into the smallest square inch. So how is it important to read poetry out loud? It is absolutely important, because I think it is the exercise of the dying breath, and it enacts that kind of tightrope walk that we do when we are alive. We exercise the increase of meaning while vitality decreases. Does that make sense? Okay. Ah, thank you. What has the Bible meant to your poetry? The Bible is just a huge source of poetry itself, you know, and you know, the whole idea of in the beginning was the Word. The Judeo-Christian tradition says that in the beginning was the Word. But because a word is, by definition, by virtue of its function, its identity, a relational entity, you could say, in the beginning was relation. So it seems to me, and in fact, wiser, smarter people than me have said that. And the Bible, I think, is an enactment of that relationship between the daemon, the God, and you know what? Ultimately, what the Old and New Testaments read in the sequence, that in the King James sequence, what it enacts, I think, is the recognition of the unconscious and understand and some sort of introjection of the God figure. I'm just making it up. I have no idea what the heck. Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Okay, here's one. You are labeled an Asian American poet. Do you see yourself that way? In what ways are you a Chicago writer? Well, I am, of course, Asian American. I'm Chinese. I was born in Indonesia. But that doesn't account for all of who I am. You know what I noticed is this. When I started reading Robert Frost, I felt so seen. I felt invisible before I read Robert Frost. Isn't that weird that some dead white guy from New England made me feel visible? How do you account for that? Then I started reading Emily Dickinson. This dead white woman from New England. I felt visible. I thought, oh, Emily, you see me. How do you account for that? She's not Asian American. I'm not from New England. So there must be something in poetry that is unaccountable, that is trans-historical, transpersonal, that's not easily, you can't account for it just by your race, your gender, your age, your personal history. There's something beyond all that. You know, I read Rainer Maria Rilke. I feel completely visible. I feel, I walk through the world, I look at the culture, I look at movies, I look at magazines, I feel invisible. I feel like nothing in this culture sees me. And then I read this German guy, right, from the previous century, German, Austrian, right, from the previous century, and I feel visible. How do I account for that? I don't know. But I read the ancient Chinese. I feel visible. I feel seen. You know, Rilke, in fact, says this about... Do you know this poem, Archaic Torso of Apollo? Rilke, the poet, is in a museum. He's looking at this torso, this Greek torso of Apollo. And he says something like, I'm paraphrasing it really badly, but he says something like, there's nowhere on this piece of marble that doesn't see you. You must change your life. I think what happens is the real service or the great boon of art is that it enacts or accomplishes an I-you experience. When I read a great poem, I feel as if that poem says you to me. But I walk through the culture day and night, and I don't feel called to in any way at all, you know. So do I see myself as an Asian-American poet? Sure, but not only. And in what ways are you a Chicago writer? I don't know if I'm a Chicago writer. I live in Chicago, but living in a city has made me, in fact, more interior. Because there's so much, you know, when you live in a city, you look around and all you see is the human hand. Sometimes it's good, and then sometimes you want to get beyond the human, you know, to something, the root of human being. I guess that's all we have time for. Thank you very much.
That was Lee Young Lee speaking as part of Poetry Downtown in 2008. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. And to help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today at literary-arts.org/donate. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.